Oh.
Today in Studio 360.
Oh, God.
Faking it.
I'll have what she's having.
No. Not like that. It's the name of a great museum show up now about the history of faking photographs. I'll talk with two photographers about this, a married couple. He's a celebrated darkroom guy. She's totally Photoshop.
It's all about like sampling different points in time in a way and putting them, weaving them together to tell a story.
And we'll launch Studio 360's first Photoshop contest. And a musician dreams up a stage name and a new genre for her brand of North Americana, Doom Soul Gothic Gospel.
We fell from a dying tree. We wait for it to leave.
Cold Specs performs live right here. That and a lot more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by PBS, presenting The Dust Bowl, a new film from director Ken Burns, starts Sunday at 8, 7 central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, the Canadian band Cold Specs performs live in the studio.
I've walked behind you, assumed power in the dead of night.
And if you're in the mood for something more tropical, we've got a lesson in hula.
You shake your bottom, or your okole as we call it, and it just looks very sexual, but it really isn't. It's a movement of the body telling the story of the song.
But first, let's talk about Superstorm Sandy.
Now, on the west side now is starting to flood over. The lower east side is starting to flood as well. And here in Battery Park City and all of lower Manhattan, there are about 250,000 people without power, 2 million throughout the entire tri-state area.
3 weeks later, there are still so many urgent needs from the aftermath that need attention, wrecked housing, power out, and all the rest. But here in Studio 360, we wanted to begin exploring some of the big long-term urban design questions facing New York and other coastal cities. Fortunately for us, lots of planners and engineers and architects have been thinking a lot about this for a decade or more. They've drafted some detailed proposals, visionary and down-to-earth, to try to protect our cities from storms like this. The person behind one set of proposals is the architect Adam Yurinsky. He's a principal and co-founder of the Architecture Research Office, a firm in Lower Manhattan. Adam Yurinsky, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So the central piece of your plan is soft edge engineering, as it's called, which is this combination of wet, mossy wetlands and tidal salt marshes and spongy streets. Explain.
The proposal that we had was really two parts. One was a series of network of streets that would absorb, distribute, and collect both fresh water from storms as well as salt water or brackish water from a storm surge. They would then deliver that water to freshwater and saltwater wetlands ringing the edges of Manhattan that would process that runoff, clean it before it returns to the harbor. So those two elements really formed this soft infrastructure, or what we call an ecological infrastructure.
And even though you're addressing very 21st century issues of how the city is built up, you're in some measure it seems like you're going back to the way Manhattan was 400 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the flood boundaries reveal is the pre-settlement or European settlement contours of the island. That's what you begin to see as water level rises. And this idea of a gradient or a slope that surrounds the perimeter of the island as a kind of buffer zone that can absorb some of the force of a storm surge, certainly that's the way natural systems work.
Instead of just being flat out to the water.
Yeah, flat out to the water with a vertical seawall, which as incremental water levels rise, that boundary gets, of course, overtopped by the water itself.
the governor of New York and other people have also been talking these last few weeks of massively multi-billion dollar engineered seawalls, which have been built successfully around Europe and in Japan. It seems to me those ought to be on the table as well. It's not an either-or thing between what you've envisioned and those kinds of solutions.
I think that's true. The question is, where is it practical to do that, and where are there, what are you protecting? So there are scenarios for one large barrier way out by Sandy Hook. There's others with three barriers. The challenge with all of those is what's the backup if the barrier fails?
If you were given the go-ahead, what would this look like?
Overall, the rendering that we prepared, a sort of aerial view of Lower Manhattan, which is this kind of city that is still present, still occupies the space that it occupies now, but now has a kind of green edge, a watery edge. That's certainly what we envision would happen. I think that there'll be...
Like 100 yards? Like how big of a soft green edge?
It varies depending upon the depth of the water surrounding the island. So one of our ideas was to notch into Battery Park City to create space for wetlands, to create shallower areas there. We also proposed a series of constructed barrier islands that are off the tip of Manhattan to help blunt the force of a storm surge coming up from the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. So there's a kind of one of the old-style railroad engine cow catchers, if you will, on the front of – on the bottom of south end of Lower Manhattan that would function in that way. So
– sounds sort of steampunky.
Yes. No, it would be quite beautiful, and there would be more habitat for birds, for marine life. So it's all part of, it's all of a piece, really all connects.
So in addition to protecting and mitigating these big storm surges, it could be nice.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole point, ultimately, that this is something which is an opportunity, not simply a catastrophe, and it's something that can improve the quality of life in the city quite a bit.
Adam Yurinsky, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Adam Yurinsky is principal and co-founder of the Architecture Research Office. You can see his firm's designs for a new New York City waterfront at studio360.org. And what do all of you think? What approach should government, not just in New York, but elsewhere, take in reshaping the waterfronts of our coastal cities? Tell us at studio360.org.
Water, so much water's under the bridge. Have not seen you since I was 21, and you know I was just a kid.
Coming up now, an artist makes her dreamy photography more precise.
The idea of using the computer and being able to manipulate the images more and get exactly what I wanted for a still life image was something that immediately appealed to me.
Art in the Age of Photoshop. That's coming up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Fox Searchlight Pictures with Hitchcock, starring Anthony Hopkins as Alfred Hitchcock and Helen Mirren as his wife Alma, in theaters November 23rd.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and I want to invite you to a special event in New York City on Thursday, November 29th. We're partnering with the Story Collider to bring you a night of live storytelling about memory, the way it plays tricks on us, colors the world around us, and sometimes goes missing. That's Thursday, November 29th at 8 p.m. at WNYC's Green Space. Details and tickets are at studio360.org. There is a terrific show up now at the Metropolitan Museum here in New York. In fact, I'm planning to go back and see it a second time. It's called Faking It, Manipulated Photography Before Photoshop. It's got hundreds of strange and fascinating pictures from the first century and a half of photography. The idea, and it's not a new one, is that picture-taking was never a purely truthful, accurate documentary medium. From the start, photographers have messed around with images with lots of different techniques for lots of different reasons. They made multiple exposures in the camera or combined multiple images in the darkroom, retouched prints afterward, and more. But never before this exhibition have so many great examples, famous and unknown, been assembled all together. As I was wandering through the show, I realized that you could plot every image along two axes. One axis is whether the manipulation makes the image look real or unreal. The other axis I'd call romantic versus cynical. So with those two axes, one horizontal and one vertical, I started putting every image I saw into one of the four quadrants. You can see a diagram of what I'm talking about at studio360.org. So, for instance, in this picture I'm looking at right now, an 1850s portrait of a guy sitting indoors, there's a church steeple perfectly visible outdoors through a window. But it's actually two images made on one plate. The manipulation puts the steeple in the window because it makes a better picture, more beautifully true to life. So this would go in my romantic realism quadrant. Or take this famous picture of Lenin and Stalin sitting together in 1922. It was retouched in 1949 to make Stalin look better and bigger and Lenin smaller. Very realistic and totally cynical. What about today's digital manipulations? The photoshopped images all around us in style magazines and advertising want to seem super realistic, while all the antiquing filters and features we play with on Instagram acknowledge fakery and have fun with it. In the exhibition Faking It, a lot of the work is art, romantic and unreal. Like this one, a famous photo of two men sitting in a bathtub facing each other. They're actually the same man, Jerry Yulsman. He revived surreal photo montage in the 1960s and 70s, and he's still doing it today, the old-fashioned way.
I've had images that I've worked on for like 2 or 3 weeks in the darkroom. You know that the idea is a viable one, but you're not quite sure how to resolve it, you know, visually.
His wife, Maggie Taylor, is also a photographer, and she also makes surreal photo montage. But she swears by Photoshop.
I love sitting at a desk and working. I'm kind of nerdy about things. And the idea of using the computer and being able to manipulate the images more and get exactly what I wanted for a still life image was something that immediately appealed to me.
Yulsman started his career as a wedding photographer in the 1950s. But in the 60s, as the culture was starting to bend the rules in all kinds of ways, Jerry did some experimenting of his own, blending images to create trippy, meticulous, gorgeous, otherworldly landscapes.
Well, it is interesting because I've always felt that my images benefited from the fact that photography has a kind of inherent believability, that people look at these images and then there's sort of a psychological dissonance of like, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here, a kind of magical realism or whatever. It is interesting because the purist, I was actually raised in the purist tradition when I studied initially with Minor White, but at least he would talk about the photograph as being a metaphor, that you could photograph something not only for what it is, but for what else it is, that it had these layered meanings to it.
But when your work, so unlike almost anything else being made at the time, came out, what was the reaction of the gatekeepers and mandarins? Yeah. And
well, it was very interesting because it was somewhat controversial. The one comment that I got that just always sort of blew my mind is I'd come to New York and I'd show these images to people that were fellow photographers, and they usually would say, well, this is very interesting, but this is not photography. And I think, you know, I buy everything at the camera store. I spend long hours in the darkroom. What are we going to call it? You know, it didn't. But they were limited in their aesthetic in terms of what they thought photography could be.
15 or 20 years ago, when Photoshop was still pretty new, Photoshop approached you and wanted to embrace
right.
you. Tell me about that.
All right, here's the story. They contacted me and said, would I do a poster for them? But they sent a fellow to come to Gainesville, and it was me, you know, telling him what to do. I didn't know how to operate the computer, and we authentically built an image. They made a poster out of it, and then everybody's calling me. Said, oh, yes, I see you've switched over, crossed over to the dark side, as some people say. And they said, well, tell us now about your Photoshop work. And I said, well, I remember my first Photoshop image. I remember my last one, same image. Part of this story where it affects Maggie Taylor, my wife, is, well, this was going on. She was watching this whole process. And when he left, she sat down at this computer and it fit in with the kind of things she had been working with in her own photography career, and it sort of launched that in another direction.
So, Maggie, as Jerry was saying, I'm sticking with the old ways, you were instantly excited? Is he telling this story correctly?
It's true. I was immediately captivated by it, and I had never loved the darkroom. But I always was comfortable typing, and so I just picked it up immediately and started playing with it.
It's interesting. It's as if Photoshop allowed you to be more engaged in a kind of hands-on craft way, the way that Jerry is engaged and loves the, you know, black and white work in the darkroom.
Right. And once I had the computer, I sort of mimic his method of working in a certain way, because he goes out in the world and shoots photographs and collects them. He has this collection of all these contact sheets of the
components,
film over the years,
yeah.
All these components. He's got a library of components, basically, and then he can go in and sort and pick and choose and work with things. And that's basically what the computer's letting me do now.
So your work became less realistic?
Yes, it definitely moved away from the idea of it used to be, here are some objects that I love and I've arranged them this way and photographed them to give them some kind of permanence. And now it's all about like sampling different points in time in a way and weaving them together to tell a story.
Including, for instance, tintypes, as old school as you can get in photography.
Right, right.
And what about you, Jerry, as Maggie was embracing the digital age totally? Were you disapproving?
Oh, no. I don't think art is a competitive sport, and I was excited to see her involved with this sort of in-process discovery, because she, you know, once she began manipulating at the computer, it gave her freedom to deal with subtleties, to change things. And I don't know, I think it's a much more engaging kind of process when you're going to the fringes of your own understanding and you're thinking, well, now I wonder what would happen if. To me, it's much like the broader-based world of art is for the painters and sculptors.
But are you not tempted to say, you know, Control-Z, I can, that didn't work, I'll change it, I'll do something new. That doesn't appeal to you at all?
Well, I understand. The one thing she may not want me to say, but she's, you know, she went to Yale, she's part of the overeducated, and so she could deal with all this stuff. I see her working on the computer now, because she'll ask my opinions on things she's working on, and she'll have like 200 layers of something to remember these things, and I, you know, what I used to do is I had the blues playing loudly in the dark room, and I've got my limit range of things, different enlargers. It's a much more narrower field, and I see the options that she has. Sometimes I have to say I'm jealous of the fact that, you know, she can make things sharper. There's a concept. You know,
yeah. Well, why? It sounds as though you are not negative at all about the effect of the computer and digital and Photoshop on photography.
No. What bothers me is some people have a very narrow definition of photography. A poetic definition that I like is that photography is simply light remembering itself. You know, it's another system for making marks on paper. And if you do it with a computer, if you do it in the darkroom, there's a variety of ways of doing it. And it's not like one is better than the other.
Well, in the spirit of manipulated photography, we are mounting a challenge for our listeners, a kind of contest. Each of you, Maggie and Jerry, have provided images, a butterfly, a man in a hat, leaves, and we're asking you, the listeners, to use those images that Maggie and Jerry have provided to create a composition. And you're free to add, subtract, augment, do whatever you want by whatever means you wish. What kinds of approaches, Maggie, do you think might make a successful piece out of these components?
Well, I suppose if I were starting to work with these images, I would start by layering them together in the computer and sort of shuffling things around and deciding what might work well with something else, something that sort of strikes a chord with you emotionally in some way, and try to layer things together and make a digital collage with them.
And Jerry, either technically or poetically, any advice?
Well, I always think it's important if you can work from an emotional base. You know, if you're trying to express feelings somehow, if you're trying to comment on nature or a relationship, that if you have any of those ideas and can use these elements to suggest something that relates to something you have authentic feelings about, that's a better point of departure than just moving things around visually and creating some, you know, design just for the sake of having a design.
Right.
And it's also fine if people add their own images to them. I mean, I think it's really hard to work with stock imagery or imagery that other people
right.
provide. I personally don't. I like to work with my right. own images just because they have something that taps into my brain and my history. So people can certainly feel free to add.
And you'll come back on the show and be our judges for our contest?
Yes, of course we will.
Yes.
Great. It's American Idol photography style.
I know.
The
I
thing
love
is,
it.
There's more than one right answer.
Well, you can pick more than one
yeah.
winner.
All right, there we go.
Jerry Yulsman, Maggie Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Faking It is the terrific photography show up right now at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. On our website, you can watch an audio slideshow with the images we talked about. And at studio360.org, you can find out how to enter our photo contest. For artistic purposes, Photoshop is just the latest tool for manipulating images. But did you see that shark swimming through a flooded neighborhood after Superstorm Sandy? It was all over the web for a couple of days. A few people retweeted it in a panic, but most of us shrugged. Shark swimming down the street. Ha ha. It was fake. For the first time, we really no longer assume that a photograph shows real life. One of the people who's ushering in this new world is Manish Agrawala. He's a professor of computer science at the University of California, Berkeley, where he runs the Visualization Lab. He's also a MacArthur genius. I asked him how Photoshop itself had changed since it was introduced in 1990.
So Photoshop has evolved quite a bit over the last 20, 25 years. Back when it was Photoshop 1.0, you could go in and touch every pixel in an image, change its color, and create all kinds of effects that way. You could create an image composite by taking a picture of a person, let's say, and carefully outlining their face, cutting it out, and then pasting it on a new background.
Right.
What people have been working on for the last 20 years is to build simpler interfaces where, for example, I could just very coarsely mark a stroke on the person's face rather than carefully cutting it out in order to extract it and then composite it into a new background. And that interface really changes the speed with which you can try out different ideas.
So on the one hand, these digital tools make all kinds of bad deception possible, scams and frauds. The possibilities are huge. On the other hand, just about everybody's carrying a camera in their pocket all the time now, and so can produce photographic evidence of reality. Does the ubiquity of digital phone cameras help protect us from being deceived by digital photo manipulation?
I don't think it protects us. I think that what is changing and needs to change is that people who view photographs need to understand that there was an author who took that photograph. There was someone who decided what photograph to take, and possibly also manipulated that photograph. You know, maybe there are ways that we can help people understand that photos have been manipulated.
Well, and there is, I know, a field of image forensics where people specialize in detecting how and if images were manipulated. And how does that work roughly?
One of the things that it does is that it analyzes the compression that's been used on the photographs. So when you use JPEG to compress an image, for example, it leaves behind a little bit of a signature. And that signature is slightly different depending on the exact algorithm that you use. And so this tool looks for those changes to the signature in the JPEG compression. In particular, when you use Photoshop on an image, the parts where you've used Photoshop have a slightly different signature than the parts where you haven't used Photoshop.
So after the revolution of the last 20 years with Photoshop and digital photography and cell phone cameras, any idea about the next big disruption in how we collect and use images?
Well, I think it's hard to know what the next disruption will be.
Of course, you'd be about to become a zillionaire if you did.
But things have gotten disrupted. Video is an obvious candidate. Tools for manipulating video are on the horizon, I think. You may have seen recently Photoshop included what's called a content-aware fill tool. It allows you to easily remove an object from an image. You essentially outline the image using a magic wand or whatever, press delete, and the system automatically fills in the hole that's left behind in a way that looks very realistic.
The Soviet dream.
That's right. One of the exciting directions is to take that kind of a tool that's been designed for images and now apply it to video. You're a tourist taking a video of your family at a tourist site, and a stranger walks into your video. You can press a button and take them out.
Uh-huh. Gotcha.
There's also advances in camera technology. So you may have heard of this new camera, the Lytro. It's a camera that takes an image that can then be refocused after you've taken the image.
The moment at which a photograph is taken, which used to be sort of everything in photography, is no longer necessarily so salient.
That's right. Yeah. It changes the way we think about what a photograph is.
Manish, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Manish Agrawala is a computer science professor at UC Berkeley and one of the scientists on the advisory board of Studio 360's Science and Creativity series. Every year, the Library of Congress chooses 25 recordings to preserve forever as part of the National Recording Registry. This year, one of the recordings they've chosen is Hula Medley by the Hawaiian guitarist Gabby Pahinui. It's not the usual slidey Hawaiian guitar of grass skirt tourism ads. Rather, it's a style known as slack key, where the player retunes the strings to play different chords. That technique was introduced to the world by Hula Medley when it was released in 1947. To tell us about it, we'll hear from Gabby Pahinui's son.
Aloha, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Cyril Pahinui. I am the son of Gabby Pahinui.
A music historian.
My name is Jay Junker. I'm an ethnomusicologist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
And a musician who performed with Gabby.
My name is Nikki Hines. I have been playing music professionally since I was 11 years old, so that's a good 75 years. I'm going to give you one conk on your head and tell you sit down and pay attention. It's not easy to play a slacky guitar unless you know what it is you're doing, because the strings are not tuned in the ordinary key styling. It's tuned according to the way the person wants it to be tuned, and they derive their own slacky melody that way.
So all the things that my dad does, it's not in the books. You cannot find it nowhere else. Only way you can find it when you listen to the LPs. CDs like that.
I heard that Gabby Pahinui got the name from wearing gabardine pants. The name slack key or kiho'alu actually refers to the slacking or the loosening of the strings to tune them into an open chord. Many of these techniques have evolved over the years and tend to mimic vocal techniques and rhythms that have been used in Hawaiian chant and hula. Prior to the 1940s, Slack Key was a very closely guarded family secret. It was really a folk tradition that you heard at private parties, at jam sessions. People would not share tunings, people would not share techniques, but once these recordings came out, they're signaling to other musicians, it's okay to go public. Which is being preserved this year, is instrumental, and that makes it somewhat radical in traditional Hawaiian music. You didn't have purely instrumental music.
Well, it actually began with chants, you know, that was to perpetuate our culture, stories of people, places, and things.
Hula is primarily the choreography based on the sounded word.
A hula is a movement of the body. You use your hands to tell the story and you shake your bottom or your okole, as we call it. And it just looks very sexual, but it really isn't. It's a movement of the body telling the story of the song.
I started playing guitar when I was about 7-8 years old. And just learning from pops, what we call the open tunings, or tuning your guitar to a note. For 7 years, I played with Chet Atkins. Chet Atkins told me, Cyril, here in Nashville, we call that open tunings. So I told Chet, well, back home, we call it slack key, kiho alo. And I showed him a tuning, which I play on open C tuning. He never did heard of this tuning that I play. C, G, E, G, C, E. So that's an open C. Open C tuning. And you don't have to press anything. Just strum it. The guitar is in C.
I first met Gabby Pahinui about 45 years, almost 50 years ago. He was playing music in the backyard of his house. He could play anything, and he was very open to any kinds of songs. If he didn't know it, he just made it up. It was in him.
Well, I always like to think of Gabby Pahinui as an artist who is larger than life. And in that way, I would compare him to 20th century legends like Louis Armstrong, Jimmy Rogers, Bob Marley, Bill Monroe, Elvis Presley, Mahalia Jackson.
He's the boss. He's everything. He's just like Elvis, or he's just like Chet Atkins. He's the king in Hawaiian music.
We heard from the musician Cyril Pahinui, the singer Nikki Hines, and the ethnomusicologist Jay Junker talking about Hula Medley by the guitarist Gabby Pahinui. It's this 1947 recording that has just been preserved in the National Recording Registry. Our story was produced by Ben Manila. And you can hear all of our stories about works in the National Recording Registry over the last few years, from Carmen Miranda to REM to Mel Brooks. That's at studio360.org. Coming up, don't ask the musician who calls herself Al Specs what her real name is, because wouldn't that defeat the whole point of having a pseudonym?
I think the artist is a separate individual from the person, and I wasn't comfortable with the idea of strangers knowing who I was.
Al Specs performs live with her band Cold Specs. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
The human heart will refrain. It is all the same. Heavy hand.
fire away.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish music, fun, culture, and lots more. For those interested in uncovering their roots, renewing a love of Ireland, or discovering it for the first time, more information at discoverireland.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Musicians these days don't have to depend on their labels or critics to categorize the music they make. They can do it themselves when they upload their songs to iTunes or SoundCloud. The musician who's going by the name Al Specs invented a new genre for herself, doom soul slash gothic gospel. It started out as a joke, but it stuck, and it's not really inaccurate. The band she's put together to play her music is called Cold Specs. They're in New York to start their North American tour. She and two of her musicians are here with me now. Al Specs, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello.
So I have a lot to ask you about, but will you start us off with the song, Send Your Youth?
Yeah.
Great.
Waiting.
turn around to your high head. Said, oh, high, high, will you make my bed? Oh, my Lord, will you take my claim? This February child I was made for the spring.
That was Cold Specs, singer-songwriter Al Specs on vocals, with Tom Green on piano and Chris Cundy on sax, performing Send Your Youth off their new album, I Predict a Graceful Expulsion. So as I've been listening to this music, I hear, along with soul and gospel, a distinct folk piece as well. Yeah?
Yeah. I started out really, when I was in university, when I first really got into music, I was really listening to a lot of folk, like the American Anthology of Folk Music and Alan Lomax recordings. And to newer stuff like Bill Callahan and Will Oldham, a lot of that definitely seeped into my songwriting, I think.
Was it old Alan Lomax recordings that got you interested in the music of the American South and gospel and that kind of thing?
I think so. I didn't really ever listen to gospel music, but I was listening to a lot of soul singers who definitely were heavily influenced by gospel music, and I guess it's just a sort of cycle where that seeped into their music, and it naturally seeped into mine as well. It wasn't until afterwards that I went back and listened to people like Mahalia Jackson.
Given that influence and given the spiritual, existential quality of a lot of your lyrics, did you grow up going to church?
Nope.
Nope?
Not a Christian. My family's not even a Christian family. We're Muslims. My family are from Mogadishu.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're a Somali-Canadian, I guess?
Yeah.
Would be the hyphenate that you would go by? You've said in the past that when you were writing these songs, you could barely play the guitar. It must have been scary to go into a studio with all professional musicians and here I'm on the guitar.
It was really, at first, it was this incredibly daunting experience. I didn't know the people who were playing on the record very well. I didn't know my songs very well. There were a lot of unknowns.
You could have failed in so many ways.
I could have. Luckily, I didn't.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
Oh. So, well, now you're fully an adult. You began writing music when you were a teenager?
Sort of. In high school, I was attempting to write songs, just morbid, emo, teenage nonsense.
That's what teenagers do. Can we hear another one? Not teenage, emo nonsense?
Just an adult, emo nonsense. Elephant Head?
Great.
Stillborn thoughts to cradle and hold with my mother's hands. I'll place them on my chest and hope for these empty winds to breathe. No, I won't rest when the houses turn shame. Call out to these waters, yes, you great lakes. Do I bury them with names? Become me open just to see what's within. Clean up these organs, wrap your words with my skin. Yes, I'm just looking for a transplant lover with infinite regrets. Someone will dance around matters and sing of caskets. What do you say? Now what do you say? It's a strange year. It appears that I am stuck, but I predict a graceful expulsion. I predict a graceful
graceful expulsion. Stranded in the North Sea, a wild dream. Frantic city, keep me warm this fall. It's been a heavy year. Bathurst, Spadina, St. Georgian Bay. Am I to condemn the hands of darkness? Now tell it to the quiet fire of my blood. Tell it to the eager fever of my heart. Who will arrange the funeral? As I predict a graceful expulsion. I predict a graceful. I predict a graceful expulsion. 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 A graceful expulsion. I predict a graceful expulsion. I predict a graceful expulsion.
That is the band Cold Specs, Al Specs, Tom Green, and Chris Cundy performing Elephant Head from their album, kind of the title track.
Yeah.
Of I Predict a Graceful Expulsion, their latest record. You talk a lot in the lyrics on this record about Toronto, where you grew up, name particular streets and lakes and landmarks. But now you've moved to London, not London, Ontario, but the English one. Is that going from Canada back to...
Are you Canadian?
What?
Are you Canadian?
I am not Canadian.
Oh,
I'm Nebraskan. So
it's
as close to Canada as America gets in a certain way. But no, I'm not Canadian. But I'm interested in Canadians and Canada. Is that the reference of graceful expulsion, your self-deportation back to the old country?
The word expulsion represents a lot of things. Moving is probably one of them, but it's also just letting go of a lot of things. You know, people,
yeah.
Faith in things, faith in love, faith in a higher power.
Uh-huh. And Al Specs, the pseudonym, why did you decide to perform with a pseudonym rather than your lovely actual name?
I just wasn't comfortable with having my name out there. I think the artist is a separate individual from the person, and the record is really sad at times and really morbid, and I didn't want that attached to my name. And I just thought, you know, the record is was written about a certain time in my life, and that's not really representative of who I am now, and I'd rather leave my name out of it.
Keep a boundary between who you really
exactly.
are.
Exactly. It wasn't until I sort of embraced the Al Specs persona on stage that I was able to play these songs.
And I take it the real you isn't so crazy about playing shows?
The real me, if she had her way, would want to be Jan Deck.
You mean be a nobody in Nowheresville that may not exist?
Just make a bunch of records and put them online, but...
This is the business you have chosen.
Yeah, this is a bit, yeah, and I'm going to grow up and suck it up and just play shows and attempt to sell records.
Excellent. Al Specs, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me and talking with me.
Could you play us out with a song?
Sure. This last song is Blank Maps.
Cold Specs. Cold Speck's debut record is called I Predict a Graceful Expulsion. The band's touring the U.S. and Canada, and you can find out where they're playing at studio360.org.
Don't you wait on me, I'll shoot you down. Keep your eyes closed, ear to the ground. Pick up in the middle of the night, kill the silence, I can't bear to speak. Head for the heart, does it break? Words may fall, the body remains, and every map is blank.
And that's it for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Liebowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Special thanks to Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum. And our series on the National Recording Registry receives support from the Library of Congress.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we're always going on and on about creativity. In fact, we don't know what we're talking about.
When you start to study it and start to try to figure out what it is and specify its constituents, it becomes more and more and more confusing. Nobody agrees on what it is.
The truth about creativity. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.